Thank you for joining us for another episode of A Push Anxiety Attack. Please remember to review the podcast on whatever podcast service you use. In this episode, I'll discuss life in the American colonies, Southern and Northern. So, what can we say about American life in the colonial period? American life was comparatively harder than it was back in much of Europe, especially in the Chesapeake area of Virginia and Maryland. Work was very hard, the climate was very muggy, diseases such as malaria and dysentery and typhoid took a very heavy toll. So the lifespan in the Chesapeake region was only about 40 to 50 years because of all the people dying young from disease. Men wildly outnumbered women and competed to win women's hands. The ratio of men to women was about 6 to 1 in the Virginia colony through much of the 17th century. And in a sign of a complete breakdown of societal norms and values, we get the figure that in one Maryland county, one third of the brides were pregnant on their wedding day. Still, Virginia especially persisted and grew to be the most populous colony in the Americas. Tobacco was key here. While it was a hard place to live, it really was an ideal place to grow tobacco. Exports rose from 1.5 million pounds of tobacco each year in the 1630s to 40 million pounds by 1700. But the increase in production and therefore supply meant that prices fell. This is what happens when you have more of something available. But if the income from selling your tobacco drops as prices drop, the only solution the tobacco farmers had was to plant and grow even more tobacco, which, of course, then led to an increasing drop in prices. To understand this population growth in a colony with so few families, we should talk about the headright system. It's going to seem a little familiar to the Dutch patroon system, but far more informal. In the headright system, any time a wealthy landowner sponsored the passage of an indentured servant to the Americas, that is, you know, bought an indentured servant, he also gained the right to purchase an additional 50 acres of land from the crown at a very low price. Land was being gobbled up by the rich, who could afford to sponsor these indentured servants, while increasingly becoming out of reach for the poor. And even if your indenture contract required the employer to give you land at the end of your indenture, it's very possible he would simply refuse to give up land and give you a cash payout instead. But that was useless because there was no land to buy with that money. As we saw, initially indentured servants provided sufficient labour for tobacco cultivation. Life as an indentured servant was obviously very tough, and the risk of death from disease very high, but after the term of indenture, usually 7 to 10 years, they knew they would be free. But as time went on, and labour became harder to find, especially when word got back that indentures weren't getting the land payout they were hoping for, masters became very intent on extending contracts. In fact, having your indenture extended became one of the most common legal punishments for indentured servants. That's literally what the court would sentence you to for a crime. I think this means there's almost an inevitability to the development of race-based slavery in the colonies. That is, of course, not excusing the individuals who participate in it or suggesting it was unavoidable, but there's a depressingly obvious slide towards it. So, as indentured servant numbers decrease, we see a corresponding increase in slavery. By the late 17th century, the Chesapeake had grown into a difficult situation where a generation of young male settlers were frustrated by the system. These were young white men who'd come often as indentured servants, but had no land at the end of it, so they were landless and jobless. No landlord was going to hire them when indentured servants or slaves were much better value. There were no women in the colonies, so they couldn't start families, and the overriding goal for these men was pretty simple. Get land, get money, get married, perhaps secure a small amount of political power or representation for themselves along the way. A good example of these men is Nathaniel Bacon. In 1676, he led what has been known as Bacon's Rebellion. About 1,000 men joined his uprising, but it's a more complex story than just saying Bacon wanted land. There are elements of race and class playing in here as always. Bacon and his followers wanted land. The land was all held by wealthy landowners who looked down on these poor landless men. These poor white colonists would seek out land where the wealthy landowners didn't own it, but that land was always on the frontier of the colony, in the foothills of the Appalachians. That land wasn't owned by the rich, it was owned by the native tribes. When they take that land, those tribes would push back and attack them. Then the colony has to defend them. Of course, the governor of Virginia, William Berkeley, would prefer not to be drawn into war with the native tribes, especially for a bunch of poor folks he doesn't care about anyway. He was very happy keeping the tribes in the mountains working with the fur traders and making the colony more wealthy. He wanted to keep the peace, which was working out economically great for the colony and the rich folks of Virginia. Berkeley refused to crack down on the native tribes, and in fact he banned white settlers from going into the foothills. This caused immediate tension. On one hand, you have Bacon saying, "You have to protect us, we should be going out and driving the natives from this land so we can take it." On the other hand, you have William Berkeley saying, "Everything is fine as it is, the fur trade is bringing in money, and the rich people of the colony aren't having to pay to fight another war, so stop causing trouble, Bacon." Initially, Bacon's rebellion was incredibly successful. They drove William Berkeley from the colony capital, England was forced to send troops, but after this initial success, Bacon died of disease, those English troops arrived, and with the leader gone, the rebellion was crushed. The uprising did leave a lingering fear of revolt and lawlessness from the lower classes. On top of this, there's fear that during the uprising, some escaped slaves had sided with Bacon. There's a terrible fear that a union could emerge between these two oppressed groups, on one hand the black slaves, and the other hand the poor whites. And this led to laws that specifically banned the alignment of these two groups. A white person caught with an escaped slave would be punished extra harsh. While we're talking about slaves, here's a really grim statistic. In the 3 centuries following Columbus's landing, 7 million African slaves were brought to the Americas. But in that same period, only 400,000 were brought directly to North America. Most went to the Caribbean islands and to South America. But things were changing by the late 1600s. In 1670, black slaves made up only 7% of the southern population. But by 1680, we reach a tipping point. Wages in England have risen. Fewer younger people are choosing to come to America. Colonial powers are also fearful of another Bacon-like revolt of the white population and are wary of bringing more indentured servants in. Thus, by the 1680s, for the first time you have more black slaves being brought into the American colonies than white immigrants. And the slave trade quickly quickens considerably. By 1750, slaves make up almost half the population of Virginia. It's just a truly incredible increase. Most of these slaves have come from the coast of West Africa. They're usually captured by tribes that have a relationship with the European traders and shipped over by what is known as the Middle Passage in the Triangle slave trade. Terribly cramped conditions, usually ending up in the West Indies, and death rates on this trip are often around 20%. Again, we talked in previous episodes about the idea they would be brought to the West Indies and seasoned there on the islands. If they survived the conditions on the West Indies, many of them were then brought to North America. The big slave import cities at this time in the English colonies were Charleston in South Carolina and Newport in Rhode Island. Some of the slaves would gain their freedom, though it was rare. Some freed slaves even ended up owning slaves themselves, but eventually the opportunities for freedom dwindled, and the chance of this got smaller and smaller. As time went on, questions of the legal status of slave ownership arose in the colonies. Laws were passed making slaves and their children classified as property. We have a word for this, we call it chattel property, to their owners for their entire lives. So, not only do they own the slave, they also own any children of that slave. Then, of course, their children, and so on. In some colonies, they even made it a crime to teach slaves to read, for fear they would organise a revolt or read ideas that challenged their circumstances, and also to underline and continue to make divisions between them and the poor whites. Conversion to Christianity didn't result in any form of freedom or change of status either. There was no question, even though much of the early rationale for slavery was about them not being proper Christian people like the white people. Even becoming Christian, therefore, didn't qualify them as real people in the eyes of the colonists. You'll not be surprised to know that life for a slave in the South was very harsh. The conditions and the labour would just sap their life away. Rice and indigo plantations, like those in South Carolina and Georgia, turned out to have harsher conditions even than the tobacco plantations of Virginia. However, despite these hardships, a unique culture emerges from this, a blending of African and European culture, and the black people evolving their own languages. An example is Gula, a culture and language that evolved in the region, incorporating English words along with words from a range of West African languages. music that mixed West African music, European instruments, and a blending of range of African cultures created a sound that would be the distant ancestor of modern jazz music. And some slaves became very talented craftspeople in areas such as carpentry, bricklaying, leather tanning, all the things that are essential in a colonial setting. But the majority of slaves did simple hard labor in the fields. Desiring their freedom, many slaves rose in revolt. It would be incredibly incorrect to imagine the slave population as a docile and broken workforce. For example, in New York City in 1712, a slave revolt killed a dozen white citizens. 21 of the black population were executed in response. In 1739, along the Stono River in South Carolina, about 50 slaves rose up and tried to escape slavery by making their way to Florida, but they were intercepted along the way by the state militia. Overall, these revolts were small and not connected, certainly smaller than Bacon's Rebellion, and likely because of the changes in the colonies that happened since that time. But they were enough to terrify the white population and lead to increasingly harsh laws to control slaves. As time went on, a large gap emerged between the rich and poor in the southern colonies. In places like Virginia, we see a rigid hierarchy develop, with the planter aristocracy, the descendants of the earliest families who brought up all the good lands, the families like the Fitzhughes, the Lees, you know, the Washingtons. These families owned huge amounts of plantation land, dominated politics in the colony's House of Burgesses, and they're often known as the first families of Virginia. They were aristocratic, but also keen businessmen, running very profitable plantations that had endless problems and issues to deal with on a daily basis. It's worth noting, because this will come up later, that despite being called aristocratic from an American perspective, they were certainly not seen as aristocratic by the noble families back in England, who looked down on these families who had only made their money in the last 100 years. Beneath these large landowners were the small farmers, also known as yeoman farmers. This is the largest social group in Virginia's white population. They owned small plots of land, and if they had a bit more money, maybe they owned a couple of slaves. Next on the social scale were the landless whites, and these people were often former indentured servants, though that percentage was dropping as slaves increasingly took on that job. At the very bottom of the social scale, of course, were slaves, who had no rights and no hopes really of gaining any by this time. One of the great tools for keeping that potentially dangerous poor white population in check is to have an even more disadvantaged group beneath them. Your life may seem terrible if you're a poor white in the South, but at least you're not a slave, because they have it way worse than you. In the South, you do not really have many established social hubs because of the nature of plantations and the spread out farms, so you have a few towns, churches, and so on to bring people together regularly. In contrast, up in the north, you have a much more family-centered society. The climate and conditions in New England are much healthier, the water is cleaner, there's far less risk of disease, so life expectancy was often higher and could go as high as 70 in the north. Unlike in the Chesapeake, where most immigrants were single and male, entire families moved to New England, and this led to stability. Women married in their early 20s, and they often gave birth every 2 years until they reached menopause. So an average woman often gave birth to 10 children, and it might expect to raise about 8 of them, losing some to birth or in infancy. Women also had almost no power outside the home. In the South, women often had more social weight because of the ratio of men to women favoured the women heavily, and men often died young so that women might inherit their lands and wealth, making them property-owning widows, one of the only ways women could really own property in their own right in this period. But in the North, women were rarely allowed to inherit their husband's land or money. This would undercut the power of men and the stability of the family. So in this situation, it would revert to the dead husband's family. Women could not participate in any leadership role in the church and were completely barred from any political power. The Bible was used to justify this idea that men were to run the church and their households. Life in the Bible commonwealths can be seen as very stern. The top priority was to protect the institutions, the church, marriage, the family. This is very well illustrated in The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne, where the heroine is forced to wear a bright red A on her bosom so everyone is aware of her sin of adultery. There was no greater crime in some ways, as it was seen as attacking male power, family, and the church. This structured nature was very clear in the way New England towns developed. When a town was first chartered by the colony, it was planned and laid out in advance. They would put a town square with a town hall, a church and a school, and the first building that had to be built was the church, then the school. Education was quite highly valued. Towns of at least 50 families had to provide a primary school, and a town of at least 100 families were required by the Commonwealth to build a secondary school. Notably, Harvard College is established in 1636. It's the nation's first higher college, established to train priests. In comparison, Virginia's first college, William and Mary, isn't established until 1693. The local congregation ran Puritan churches. This was, after all, the Congregational Church. This organized group got to select their own pastor and set rules for their activities. This idea of a self-governing church laid a groundwork for a self-ruling government. There's an easy slide to see how New Englanders began to see themselves as not having only the ability, but the right to govern themselves. Puritan leaders began to worry about the religious devotion of the people in the colonies. Religious passion seemed to be dying down as the subsequent generations were born in the colonies. You got a pushback of more firebrand preaching against this growing lack of religious devotion among the younger members of the church. It's far easier to lack religious conviction when you did not spend time as a persecuted religious minority in England. This younger generation had grown up in the Congregational Church, not the Church of England as the dominant religious body, and start to take for granted or even challenge its authority. You have the emergence of the Jeremiad sermon in this period, a type of stern, old-fashioned sermon, often drawing on the Old Testament and built on the stories of the prophet Jeremiah, who preached to the Israelites. These are scoldings. They berate the parishioners. They remind them that if they sin in the slightest, they'll burn in the fires of hell. The great example of this genre is by the preacher Jonathan Edwards, who wrote Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, which describes people as walking a tightrope over a pit of fire, but not really realizing how easy it would be to slip from it by any sin. The intent is to round up straying souls and scare them back to the straight and narrow. But paradoxically, church leaders also relax the qualifications for joining the church. Something called the Halfway Covenant emerged, where people could gain a sort of halfway status in the Congregational Church. You could be a member without requiring the full expression of devotion and revelation that had previously been the basis of membership. Because they need to increase church attendance and keep these less enthusiastic members coming to services, this meant those visible saints we talked about last episode had to mix with these halfwayers, and they didn't like it. We have varying levels of religious fervour in the community and religious panics that emerge from that uncertainty. Probably the best example is the Salem witch trials. In 1682, a group of young girls claimed to have been bewitched by another woman in the town. Names were named, rumours spread, accusations kept increasing, innocent people were accused, hysteria took hold. And by the end of it, 20 people had been executed, sometimes in very gruesome ways. Rather than tramping down on it, the colony governor began an investigation into all these witches, and it was really only wrapped up when the governor's own wife was accused of being a witch. Once powerful people start getting accused, they were not going to let it keep going. You know, hang on, you can have your little witch craze, get it out of your system, but we're not going to let it go beyond that and start to undermine the position of the powerful. So by 1693, the Salem residents returned to their senses. This type of witch hunting had been done before, but in Europe the high point had been around 100 years earlier. It was rare to see it this late, but in the colonies it had a bit of a renaissance at this time. Though, if we scratch the surface, we might get to the bottom of it a bit. Salem was a town in trouble. Its economy was going for a dip, its social structure was breaking down, and there was a panic about the faithfulness of local worshippers. This kind of hysteria is a symptom of a society in crisis. It's notable, of course, that almost all the victims are women. They are persecuting the most vulnerable part of society, and they're also reminding women of the strict gender roles and restrictions in society. Stay in line, do what you're told, obey the gender rules, or else someone else might accuse you of being a witch. In terms of economy, New England's soil is thin, it's rocky, it's not great for agriculture like, say, the middle colonies, and despite the Puritans wanting to build a farming economy, the people in those areas increasingly turned to trade. Agriculture was present, but it never became a big economic success. Slavery was tried, but without large-scale plantations, it never became worth the cost. It wasn't needed so much when you had families to do the job. One of the results of this is that New England was much less ethnically diverse than the southern or middle colony. There was little draw to bring people there, and no incentive to force people to move there. Rivers do run very narrow and fast in New England, and this will become valuable as water wheels become more common, but the most important characteristic of the region is probably fishing. There's a great cliche that shows up in many school textbooks: New England is founded on God and cod. Once again, we have to talk about this contrast in way of life and economy. Another big contrast we should consider is that, certainly by 1700, there was almost no possibility to move upwards in social class within the southern colonies. The big families owned the big plantations, and thus owned the power and the money. Whereas in the north, without that type of single product economy, it was certainly viewed that hard work and determination could lead to one moving up in social class. Next episode, we'll examine the situation in the colonies during the run-up to the revolution, and really get into the growing colonial identity that plays a crucial role in it.